my way to Hades, and I am on the way to hell. What is this thing?
Can't do it. We'll do it live. We'll do it live. Do it live. I'll write it and we'll do it live. And thing sucks.
And WBAI, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I think you guys are doing a terrific job. There's some wonderful people overnight. I think Max Schmid is brilliant and R. Paul Martin is brilliant, but I don't know how many people get to hear them. And I want to say thanks. A tremendous job.
Well, thank you very much for that.
Sweltering 90 degree studio, WBAI New York. I'm your curator and janitor for the Dustbin of History, Max Schmid. Yeah, they were supposed to fix the air conditioning today. Now they say, oh, Friday. Friday, when the weather cools down. That's nice. That's very nice. Oh, boy. It's been brutal in here for the last several days. There ain't nothing I can do about it except sweat my bones off. All right, so, well, time for Lost Gene Shepherd here in the Dustbin of History. And this one is called Uncle Sam's Cereal. I'm not sure why, because, you know, I didn't have time to listen to the whole thing. I spot-checked it a bit, and I also knocked a hell of a big hum out of it. I hope, without doing too much damage to the audio, from April 17th, 1962, from the Gary Hines collection. Let's hear it. Gene Shepherd, not available anywhere online, only here in the Dustbin of History, WBAI, New York.
So I'm out there tonight on 6th Avenue, see, and I'm in my cab stance. Well, I see this guy edging over towards the curb there. He's driving a Chevy cab, of course. And he pulls up and the door opens and I get in and I sit down. And he says to me, "What's on your mind, Mac?" I said, "What do you mean?" And then with that, he starts to laugh uproariously and lasciviously. I said, "Nothing. I just want to go to 13th and 6th. Yeah, he says, "That's what I thought. That's what's on your mind." And then all of a sudden, I am conscious of this high, thin buzz in the ear. I'm always conscious of this. There's a buzz that sets off as kind of an overload relay, I think, in the back of the head there somewhere. But as soon as I am plunged into the maelstrom, it kicks. By the way, is there anyone out there got a dictionary? I suggest you look up the word maelstrom. M-A-E, as in England. Maelstrom. Maelstrom sounds like a... You all remember Victor Maelstrom, don't you? The famous Swedish director who had been a famous Swedish actor before that and a very, very famous Swedish existentialist before that. But immediately upon being plunged into the maelstrum, there is a high, thin hum that I'm very conscious of. And I suspect that among all of us here, there are many little relays that kick over at the precise moment to enable us to build up the little defenses and barricades and run out the spears and pull up the drawbridge. Can you just see yourself, you know, when the crucial moment arrives, you're sitting there with this chick and you're in this very chic restaurant and you find that you can't read French and she says, "What is this, Charles?" And you're jung, 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 and the chains are going up in your head, you know, and immediately the drawbridge is coming, clunk. And you sit there, and you're pretending you're having trouble, you know, with your foot or your shoe or something. So, well, I don't know, I think that's veal. And, of course, you're talking about Pickles pig feet. And it's a veal there, I believe. You see, it says veal there. I think it's veal there. And you say, of course, that's low French. I don't read low French. Or maybe it's, and all the while, you see, you can't entirely let the drawbridge down. Like it's, there aren't more than two or three of us at any given moment in the world, I suspect, who are really on the stick for more than 30 seconds out of the day. We're really fully conscious of what's going down, you know, everything is working. All the rest of the time it's ad-libbing. You know, it's terrible to realize the whole world is ad-libbing badly. And we get these big guys at the top, you know, we hoist them up on a petard. Oh, by the way, has anybody got a thing out there with a book there with a dictionary? I would like to have a description of a petard. It's a P-E-T-A-R-D, petard, as I have often been hoist upon my own, that kind of petard. Petard is a French, René Petard is a very famous French Grand Prix racer who raced at the Grand Prix de Monaco many years ago, but you know one. The petard, it's petard upon which I am hoist. And it is a petard upon which you are hoist, or impaled, as the case may be. A pike staff marching across. Oh, do you know about being on the other side of the pale, beyond the pale? Of course, you understand what pale they're speaking of. Has little to do with a vitamin deficiency, actually. I mean, as in, you are so pale tonight, my dear. It is something else. Of course, a lot of people confuse a spastic colon for talent. There's a kind of an inner radiance that comes from having tensions that are going on inside that gurgle up and down there around the duodenal, it pops up and down. So it's like you're perking, you know. Getting ready. Are you if you were to divide the world into people, actually, into different types of coffee pot, are you a Chemex type, you know, very chic and modern, with a kind of triangular-shaped head, and your brain, everything works very clean, you know. You know how, I don't know whether you know the kind of people who understand everything immediately, and who have all the solutions for it. They're Chemex coffee pot people. There's no problem. Nothing gets hung up in a Chemex. It doesn't blow up or explode. Just right down there, and that's the end of it. You got coffee. It's weak, but it's coffee. And, you know, it tastes, it's, you know, it's coffee. Well, sort of. And this is kind of the young American for freedom syndrome. No problems. It just goes right down through. Then there's the perk type. And for 18 hours, you just see you. And you still wind up with bad coffee and a lot of drugs, Greg's clunks down in the bottom there. And of course, the feeling about this type of person is that it takes Charlie a long time to reach a decision, but by George, when he does, he's thought it out. Well, actually, his filter is bad. It takes a long time for it to seep through, you know. It goes. once in a while. And then occasionally see that it goes blah, 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 all over the floor. It blurps out. Charlie's had a traumatic experience. He's fallen upon the floor and hit his head on the stove. And it took him a long time to reach that point, but look at him now. Ground's all over the... I'll never forget, I used to... My old man had a trick. And what he used to do, he always referred to the stuff at the bottom of the coffee pot and at the bottom of the cup as drugs. He used to say, do I always have to have coffee with drugs in it? And my mother would say, dregs. He'd say, that's what I said, drugs, all the time in the coffee. And so, you know, we were off and running. And then there's another kind. There's the drip type, of which there are many, multiple types. The drip type coffee pot person. And you know how the drip works? It goes like that, you see. 16 hours later, there's a little bit of coffee. Steady but sure. It goes and on and on. And then there's another kind. You see, this is the rugged individualist type of coffee pot, which is often employed by a ragged gentleman sitting on the side of sidings way out in the west beside the railroad tracks. You just take a whole handful of coffee and you throw it in a can and you set the fire under it with some bad water and you let her rip. This guy winds up with signs on his back that say, shame, the world is coming to an end. Very shortly. You see that great cartoon in the New Yorker, speaking of that? Shows this guy, says, the end of the world. Today, the world will end. And the cop is saying to him, now look, it's okay, but if I see you around here tomorrow, Mac... I'm sorry. I don't know. I guess it's the fallout that's making me a little... like this, you know? What do you mean, like what? Come on, what are you trying to do? You're putting me on? I'm okay. My jazz out there. Wise apple. Just because you're getting it free from the radio. That's it. Listen, if you were paying $20 a head to sit down there and listen to me and filter it through all the ice cubes, you'd think I was great. Drip-type coffee pot. I'm surrounded by knaves, idiots, fools. I will be undone by knaves and idiots. I, George, I still say, when I go, I want it carved on my headstone. He died sustaining. There's a certain honesty in being sustaining, I think. Drip-type coffee pots, Chemexes, I'm surrounded by all of them. All of them. You ever tried to reuse the grounds? You know, there's a place out in Indiana where, well, that's another thing. Yeah, well, of course, you can buy reusable grounds. All together now, let's go. Ho, 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 ho. Come. Bah, that, oh, undo trois. Yes, that. All together. How can you be teed off at the world when it's what it is?
Good luck came my way. Someone introduced me to a girl.
Hold it there. Come on there. Cut it out. Maudlin, weeping and gnashing and wailing.
Have any of you run into this thing we have this tonight? I suspect that... You can tell a lot about a country in its inadvertent movements in many ways. Do you know that there is a cereal out on the market called Uncle Sam? Uncle Sam. And it's billed as the laxative cereal. Uncle Sam. And it comes in a red, white, and blue striped package. And it has a picture of Uncle Sam on there, and it says laxative cereal. And somehow it gives you a real good, solid sense of what patriotism is all about. And, you know, it gives you a sense that there, if you can tie in a clean upper colon with clean thoughts and with goodness and with God and all the rest of it, somehow it all matches, you know, it all fits together. And in fact, I was sent a box of this stuff. I don't know why people are, the thing there, I don't know whether it's, I hate to think that it's a comment, but somebody sent me this, and inside the box there's this wonderful little booklet here of various testimonials for Uncle Sam, the laxative cereal. And one of the greatest testimonials says, I'll have to read it to you the way it's written. I first tried Uncle Sam 3 years ago. It's the finest and only thing that ever really solved my problem, writes Reverend P.G., of New York. So once again, religion failed. kind of gives you... Yes, it's terrible about that. Oh, we have a bulletin here. Ted's got a bulletin. It's very... Hurry up there, Ted.
Thank you, Gene. From the WOR newsroom, a bulletin just in. Secretary of Labor Arthur Goldberg says the Airline Pilots Association has postponed indefinitely the strike it had scheduled for midnight tonight against Pan American World Airways. A repeat on that, the strike by the Airline Pilots Association has been postponed indefinitely. It was scheduled for midnight tonight against Pan American World Airways. That's the latest on news from the WOR newsroom. Stay tuned here to 710 for further details. Here once again is Gene Shepard.
Don't be so sure, Dad. All this labor stuff. Every night I come on here, they have these very... You know, I wonder how many of you can remember last week's urgent bulletins. And the urgent bulletin of last year... Our world, really, it's a fascinating world we live in today. We live in a world of continual alarums. That's spelled with a U. And I suspect that the news and everything else that people are observing in their world today has become a kind of segment of showbiz. It's as though the whole world were taped. And, it's half rerun and half new and... In a sense, the Edward R. Murrows of our world and the Walter Lippmanns of our world are kind of like the critics. And every morning you read what Walter Lippmann said about the latest act. And you put it away, you know, like last year's hit show. Last year's gigantic, tremendous thing that you couldn't possibly miss. How many shows do you remember in your past that people assured you that you could not miss? They were so very important, and they were a very, very important experience, and you can't even remember them now. And in the end, you know, almost all of human events gets like that. Are you interested at all in the subject of perception? The subject of that shady, hazy area in between an event and your reaction to it, and man's reaction to it, his understanding of it, and then his creation of a like event that follows that event like a giant chain, you know. Are you familiar with the theory of the great road philosophy of life? Now, this is a way of looking at life as a kind of a gigantic stream where all of us are jostling on towards a certain point, a point that will never ever be reached. The illusion that we are jostling towards a point is always there. Have you ever questioned the entire concept of time? Even the concept of, say, quote, progress, great big capital letters, progress. You see, we're always assuming we're going towards something. You know, we have a split thing, you know. That's the individual destiny versus the destiny of man. And they are, in a sense, diametrically opposed, and you never can quite separate one from the other. Your destiny is there. You know you're going to die. You know, this you know secretly, always. And it's usually downhill from about the age of 12 in the average man's life, in a funny way. I mean, the knee goes bad. That's just physical. It's very difficult to appreciate daffodils at a certain point in life, when at a certain other point in life you did. Now you can pretend you appreciate daffodils. You can recall your appreciation of daffodils. And you can simulate your appreciation of daffodils. But then it gets to be increasingly difficult to do this. Until finally you probably in the end get to have a sort of daffodil-less life. Because you have outlived that part of your existence. Now, on the other hand, man remains eternally interested in daffodils. When I say man, that's in capital letters as opposed to little letters, man. Now, you are always relating to that side of the existence. Am I leaving a cloud of dust behind me here? Heading toward the polar ice cap? Wearing a pair of tennis shoes, old ones? The interesting area, though, is between those two, you know. It's that cab driver sitting, well, what's on your mind? I say, what? What do you mean? And he busts up, you know, and I said, I want to go to 13th and 6th, Mac. He said, yeah, I know. Well, of course, I had a chick with me. So what was going on in there? All of a sudden, I got the, you know, the thing in the ear, knowing that I'm once again in the maelstrom. That you'll never really separate. Speaking of maelstroms, this is WOR AM and FM New York. You will never really separate. I'm using the first definition of maelstrom there. You got it? So you never really separate yourself from that thing, you know. Now in the end, you know, it's the idea that man is going somewhere has always bugged us. And so to simulate going somewhere, we do so physically. And the more restless a nation becomes, and the more its underpinnings begin to topple, underpinnings, I'm speaking philosophical underpinnings, the more you will find a nation will have a fantastic desire to move from one place to the other. Because then you can simulate knowledge of movement and progress. Now, this goes into some pretty deep water. In fact, I'll never forget going to Enugu, which is on the coast of West Africa, this recent trip to Nigeria. And you find people there, and this is not, again, this is not the noble savage complex, but you find people there who have absolutely no desire to move. They do not understand why they should go to Lagos, which might only be, let's say, 85 miles away. You would understand why you should go to Lagos, because your life is nothing unless you move. You follow what I'm saying here? So in the end, the Western powers are out of their skull, trying to find out some way so that we can shoot a guy 9 billion miles away. Now, we don't want to ever admit that we have this thing, so we always invent goals why we should travel to these places. The invented goal is always a fascinating thing. So everybody will get together and spend billions of dollars to shoot a man, let's say, to the outer fringes of our solar system. Now, we will invent a goal there for scientific knowledge, we will say. Scientific knowledge. Well, he'll come back and say, yep, there's iron up there, too. Got plenty of iron there on that planet, and you should see they got water there. Well, all right, so now we somehow feel fulfilled for a moment until we get that scientific knowledge. Because, you see, we have to invent another goal then. Because once it's fulfilled, you're really bugged. The last thing you want, you know, is what you say you want, almost invariably. You know, you can go way down to the little old cliches. The guy gets $1 million and he's got to have more. Hardly any guy ever says, I got it, that's it, I quit. And he goes, you know, sits around and wiggles his feet. He doesn't do this, you know. He's bugged. Because you see, once you achieve that goal, oh boy. I'd like to know how many writers who are constantly talking about love who are deathly afraid of achieving it. And it's interesting to note that the more a person proclaims about these things, the less he really is involved in it. I was fascinated to find, upon talking to genuine doctrinaire communists, that the last thing they want is brotherly exchange. Personally. It's a fascinating thing, and yet they proclaim it eternally. Now, we're, of course, no different in our own ways. I presume that communication now, we're always talking about how people should communicate better. Oh, come on. I suspect that our communication is so perfect that that's why we hate each other. That everybody does communicate very well. So well that we all know one another. And for that reason, of course, the fires are never banked. The assumption is always made that if we could communicate better, we would love each other more. Oh, boy. That's a great assumption. And it's a very questionable one, too. And, you know, another one of the interesting things about it, and for those of you who've ever followed this thing, you know that I'm anything but anti-intellectual. But, you know, one of the great things that I'd like to question after having traveled around three quarters of the globe is the interesting concept that people feel that if we could educate people more, we would have less trouble. Whereas it's almost invariably the educated nations that have caused the trouble. You know? There was never a more educated nation in Europe than Germany. They turned out more philosophers, more mathematicians, more artists, more et cetera, et cetera, and they have caused their a great amount of trouble. And you know, I heard somebody say, well, if you could ever educate people, you would prove to them, if you educated people, you would get rid of such things as bias, hate. Oh, boy. Are you aware of what the educated Germans were saying in 1937? And they were educated, they were very well educated, far more educated than anybody's going to get in a parish school in Louisiana. I can assure you of that. The fascinating thing, you know, we have a thing here. Yeah, I don't know whether or not Uncle Sam's going to do it this time. We have a thing here about a new movie, The Counterfeit Traitor, starring William Holden and Lily Palmer. It is the story of a man who walked a tightrope every minute, who lived with suspense and intrigue every waking and sleeping moment, who desperately loved the woman who was his confederate in the dangerous underground movement against a formidable war machine. As you go with him step by step through the incredible dangers he faced, you will find yourself breathless. Yet this is more than one man's, et cetera, 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 et cetera. The Counterfeit Traitor, starring William Holden and Lily Palmer, starts Wednesday at the DeMille Theater, 7th Avenue and 47th Street, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Ad infinitum, ad nauseum, 1, 2, 3, 4, in hoc. All together. La na la na la na na na. Pearls and conches for all of her togs, but the flying fish and the porpoises, they followed her like dogs. She had a voice of silver and lips of coral red. She climbed the dolphin striker and kissed the figurehead. Then every starry evening she'd swim in the foam about the bows, a singing like a nightingale at home. She'd call to him and sing to him as sweetly as a bird. But the wooden-headed effigy, he never said a word. And every starry evening in the doldrum calms, she'd wriggle up the bobstay and throw her tender arms about his scarlet shoulders and fondle him and cry. The equator, where she struck a merry maid. A string of pearls and conches for all of her togs, but the flying fish and the porpoises, they followed her like dogs. She had a voice of silver and lips of coral red. She climbed the dolphin striker and kissed the figurehead. Then every starry evening she'd swim in the foam about the bows, a singing like a nightingale at home. She'd call to him and sing to him as sweetly as a bird. But the wooden-headed effigy, he never said a word. And every starry evening in the doldrum calms, she'd wriggle up the bobstay and throw her tender arms about his scarlet shoulders and fondle him and cry. The equator, where she struck a merry maid. A string of pearls and conches for all of her togs, but the flying fish and the porpoises, they followed her like dogs. She had a voice of silver and lips of coral red. She climbed the dolphin striker and kissed the figurehead.
Then every starry evening she'd swim in the foam, about the bows, a singing like a nightingale at home. She'd call to him and sing to him as sweetly as a bird. But the wooden-headed effigy, he never said a word. And every starry evening in the doldrum calms, she'd wriggle up the bobstay and throw her tender arms about his scarlet shoulders and fondle him and cry and stroke his curly whiskers. But he never winked an eye. She couldn't get an answer to her tears or moans. So she went and told her daddy, told the ancient Davy Jones. Old Davy damned his eyesight and puzzled up his wits, then whistled up his hurricanes and tore the brig to bits. Down on the ocean bed, green fathoms deep, where the wrecks lie rotting and great sea serpents creep, in a gleaming grotto all built of sailors' bones, sits the handsome figurehead, listening to Miss Jones. Songs of love she sings him the livelong day, and she hangs upon his bosom and sobs the night away. But he never, never answers, for beneath his soldier paint, the wooden-headed lunatic still thinks he's a saint. Beautiful line. Listen, just a little bit. Just give me a little touch there. What's the best line in that? Listen to this. Down on the ocean bed, green fathoms deep, where the wrecks lie rotting and great sea serpents creep, in a gleaming grotto all built of sailors' bones, sits the handsome figurehead, listening to Miss Jones. Songs of love she sings him the livelong day, and she hangs upon his bosom and sobs the night away. But he never, never answers, for beneath his soldier paint, the wooden-headed lunatic still thinks that he's a saint. Beautiful picture, isn't it? Green fathoms deep, down on the ocean bed where the wrecks lie rotting. Have you ever felt, I don't know whether you're as fascinated as I am by the things that lie rotting on the ocean bed. Do you ever think that tonight, right at this minute, not more really than a few hundred miles from here, lying there on the ocean bed is the Andrea Doria, on her side, motionless in a fantastically black Stygian night water. And you know, we're all afraid of night water. Don't kid me for a minute. Even the wildest skin diver is afraid of that dark water. Oh, yeah. And maybe more afraid than we. And there it lies. Do you know some of the things that are in the Andrea Doria lying there? They're going to have a ball when they dig that thing up. Do you know some of the things that are in that ship? I'll tell you one thing that's going to be fascinating for them to find. Just before the Andrea Doria sailed, there was placed in the hold of the Doria a handmade automobile. Do you know about that car? It was owned by the Chrysler Corporation. Now, this was not one of these so-called experimental cars, you know. These things that they put up for the shows here and there, you know, that are just used for dramatic promotions. but a truly hand-built, magnificent machine. And it was being sent to Europe for a purpose. And upon this magnificent chassis, a racing chassis it was, that cost over $100,000 just to build, one of the great Italian designers, I believe it was Farini, was going to stretch his skin. And down in that depth lies that fantastic machine with water moving over that head, caressing those aluminum discs, those brakes, back and forth over that channeled, magnificent frame built for the Grand Prix. She lies, never moved under her own power. Right at this minute. And that's just one thing. Were you ever on the Andrea Doria? One of the things they had on the Andrea Doria in one of the saloons, they had a whole wall of magnificent ceramic murals, beautiful Italian ceramics from one of the finest artists in Italy. These are waterproof, you know. And there is that scene. And you know what the scene was? Huh. Wild. The scene was a kind of three-quarter view of a long slanting coastline just outside of Naples, with a great slash of blue sky and a sort of meeting of the sea. And you could see blotches of color and paint, enamel. And down there in that Stygian depth, that magic landscape, stares forever. Does a work of art exist when no one looks at it? Just a few little fishes move past and observe the big sweep of the coast at Naples. La dia da da dia da do. La di. She's lying there right now on her side. Almost 1,000 feet of her. Do you know how long that is? If you took the Andrea Doria and sat her up on her stern, upright, she would stretch almost to the top of the Empire State Building. So if you can imagine an Empire State Building just lying flat, intact, stretched out over Jamaica Bay. Everybody think of all the things that are there. It's not a matter of thinking of things. It's a matter of there they are, you know. Just lying there. Boy. I suppose, another thing. I'll never forget one time. I was aboard an aircraft carrier. You know, it's interesting, some of the things that they're going to dig up. I was aboard an aircraft carrier one day when they jettisoned an A-4D. Now, an A-4D is a jet, almost a sonic. I think it's right at the edge of supersonic flight, but it looks like an aero, you know? Beautiful piece of equipment, just lying there, somewhere on the bottom of the Mediterranean, next to a Phoenician boat, all sunk down into the ground there, you know? And there they lie together. I saw her go down. I saw it swirl down. You look down at that green water, and it's brilliant white, you know, how they paint Navy ships. And she was pushed over, and the reason she was pushed over was a fire broke out. And it was either that or trouble, you know? So over she went, $1 million worth of aircraft or more. She hit the water, didn't even make a splash. Boom, boom. And you look down there, and you could just see her sort of swirl down. Ostensibly. There she lies. Right now, it's down there. Water moving over. Calmly. I guess you get the sense when you go to Egypt, too, that that's the way it is, too.
and that all the people that were involved in the boat, in the ship, the aircraft. And, you know, speaking of the aircraft today, I was walking along 57th Street, and a big flatbed trailer came along. And again, I must say, being an old steel-type worker, immediately you look at flatbeds. Do you know what a flatbed trailer is? This is a trailer that is used for towing, for moving over land. Very, very heavy weights. And this was a real flatbed. She was laying down there, and she had solid tires, you know, the solid rubber tires, with about 6 wheels on the back and about 8 wheels in the middle and about 9 wheels on the front and little wheels all in between. And she was maybe 6 or 7 inches of clearance off that ground. It was a real flatbed laying there with the big timbers. And a beautiful sight. I don't recommend this aesthetic pleasure to most, but to me, one of the more aesthetic pleasures around is to see a real, well, now, this one happened to be a white, but let's say a functional piece of equipment such as a big trailer tractor rig. I am always there are some beautiful trucks around these days, you know. The truck is getting more beautiful, whereas in some ways our cars that we're building are getting more like costume jewelry. But I was walking across, it was 57th Street again here a couple of weeks ago. And coming right down in the middle of all these little whoopee cars, you know, there were a couple of little MGs and stuff fooling along there and a couple of Fords. Oh boy, this great big diesel. A big white diesel. And she's sitting there, and this guy is 14 feet up in the air, you know, looking down. It's a magnificent sea green diesel. And she was a flat cab over engine type with that big window, that big panoramic window. And this is built for doing it, you know. And he had the big muffler running up the side, and he had his air filter hanging out there, and all of it's there. It's all moving, you see. And you can just feel that power pulsating in it. It's a beautiful thing. There wasn't a single piece of wasted metal on it. And walking past the stack and the muffler, you know, which is the big, you know, how the mufflers are on these things. They stick on the diesels. It comes up the side, the rear of the cab, and up over the top. You could feel the heat from about 4 feet away. You know, she just a little puff of black smoke coming out there. And this guy just sat there casually. And down below him, you could see the TR3s and the MGs. You know, little Funsville down there. And he put it in first, and you could just feel everything going at once. All these muscles moving, and he must have been towing about 9,000 gallons of radium or something in the back, or heavy water or something, because he's going across Park Avenue, of all places. You hear that momentary pause when he's going. He's got it in second now. He had at least 9 gears forward. He was shifting all the way to 6th Avenue when he got caught by the next light. I don't know whether you've ever heard a Mack trailer tractor rig coming down a hill in West Virginia, double shifting all the way down. It's a beautiful sound, and you can really tell when there's a magnificent driver at the helm. You know, when he's got all that weight, he's got 40,000 pounds behind him pushing down on him, you see. And you don't rely on brakes, unless you're a madman or a very, very new driver. And you hear him come up over the top of the hill. I remember one time, you know, you get out in West Virginia, and you drive. Have you ever been to West Virginia? Well, you drive through West Virginia, and there's a kind of bottleneck as you get towards Wheeling. And unless you're very lucky, you're liable to travel all the way across West Virginia behind 3 semi-tractor trailers. You can't get around them. Because every time you start, it's just 2-lane, you know, and it's hills, you know. Every time it's a hill up and down, you don't pass on a hill, well, it's all hills. You don't pass on a curve, and it's all curves. And it's not a super highway. You don't build super 4-lane, 8-lane highways through those mountains out there. So all these little hills are going up and down. And you get behind. I remember one time I'm driving an MG. In case you're interested, it was a TC, establishing my credentials here. And I'm behind this Mac, and I love to listen to these things and watch a real operator in charge. And you could tell he had a heavy weight. He was really loaded down. And every time we'd come here, We'd get to the top. The truck would sort of just gets up the top of the hill, and then down he starts to go, and he throws it back down to the fourth to brake with the motor, and then as the hill gets steeper, as the grade sharpens, and then finally he comes into the curve. He gets down to that curve. Up he starts to go again. And you know, it's wild. I'm sitting in there, I'm listening to all these sounds going on. And it's you can always tell, too, another thing, is how much motion is lost. There is a sound that is unmistakable. Yeah, I'm sorry, so many people who drive with automatic little shifties and all that stuff don't recognize the aesthetic kick. You know what I mean, Walt? Out of the precise moment when you slip from second into third. You know, and then if you have a four-speed shift, and at that precise moment when you go from third into high, you know, you just feel that motor just, and you go, you know, without that momentary loss of power, no pullback. It's a real art form in itself, a kind of strange little in-between craft. But I'm walking along 57th Street, see, and I see this flatbed coming along. And I'm walking with a whole bunch of kids that are just out of this science and design high school there. And I'm looking, and I see what's under that. There's this big thing is laying on that flatbed, and it's covered with a tarpaulin. Great big thing, you know, it's just lying there flat. And I can just see it all laying over the top. All the tarpaulin was all pulled down, you know, and everything is tied down neatly all the way on back. All the way back, it's tied down. And I recognize the shape immediately. And this kid is walking along, and he's with another kid, and they both look at it, and one kid says, I think it's a pregnant whale. And little do these kids realize that what has just moved right through the most chic area, right through the heart of it, you know, the Henri Bendel territory, right through Lord and Taylorsville, right through the whole business there, through Bloomingdalesville and all of it, has moved this fuselage, a fuselage of a Navy single-engine jet fighter bomber. And there she goes, the F-104, just laying there flat, all covered, a deadly, sneaky, beautiful thing, a pregnant whale. Ah, yes, dark and green where the rotting hulks lie. Dark, in a grotto made of sailor's bones. There she sits.
Lost Gene Shepherd, found for you and played for you here in the Dustbin of History, WBAI New York. That program from April 17th, 1962. Certainly covered a lot of material. Your pledges can cover a lot of expenses here at WBAI. Go to WBAI.org to make your contributions. Next week I'm going to have to hit you harder with the pitching, because we really didn't do it today. That's it for the Dustbin of History here on WBAI New York. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. Bye.
Hi, George. Well, finished with the show. What do you want me to do now?
Did you have a good time in there?
Yeah. Oh, boy, it was fun.
Great. How'd you like to do it every day?
Yeah, yeah. That would be neat. Hey, wait a minute. Do I still get to be the janitor?
Sure.
Oh, okay. It's a deal.